seconds to go. Comes in to Tucker. Ewing sets a screen. The shot is off. Loose ball. Ewing goes up. The basket counts.
Welcome, everybody, to the first inaugural episode of The Strick and Roll. Actually, there's not supposed to be the, which we discussed, but I already fucked that up, which is par for the course for most things I do. But I am joined by two very, very special guests for this first podcast. First, I would like to introduce a fellow Stricklander who really is just a power broker behind the scenes. The man who writes all the checks and gets everything done without any credit, James Marcita. James, how are you?
You speak no lies. I'm doing great. I threw out my back a couple days ago, and I have a three-month-old. So it's basically as awesome as it could be over here right now. My wife's not at all upset that I can't help out, and things are going well.
I bet you your baby's pretty happy that you can't help out, though.
She loves the shit out of me, like even more than you love me. My baby loves me.
Does she love you as much as you love The Sopranos?
No.
Okay, good, good. I was concerned for a second. But we are also joined by a fellow Sopranos connoisseur, a Knicks fan supreme, the man with the legendary Knicks advertisement ad, whatever. It's amazing. I've seen it a thousand times. David Futterneck. Dave, what's going on?
What up? I just threw out my back, and I'm going to have a really hard time holding up this episode.
K is for Knicks.
Oh, boy. Made that very hungover when I was like 25.
Well, that's the only play. That's the only way to exist when you're 25, perpetually hungover.
That's right.
Unfortunately, none of us are 25 anymore. No. But we are Knicks fans, and we are also Sopranos fans, and this is my pod. So I'm stretching the bounds of basketball to somehow tie to the Sopranos. But before we get started with all that, I guess, like, you know, we are talking about Sopranos anyway, but what did you guys think of The Many Saints of Newark?
I feel like it's way too soon to say anything, because what if it winds up... Yes, it looks like complete shit, but what if it winds up being the greatest movie of all time? In hindsight? And then I've got all these horrible clips from Strick and Roll that are just burying me as someone who understands art. So I almost feel like I don't want to say a single thing about this work.
I think it's safe to say that it was not great. It was. I went to the theater last night to see it.
Was that your first viewing? Or
My first viewing, I think it's safe to assume at this point that David Chase is better suited to television. So maybe I should rewatch it on the television and maybe I'll enjoy it more. But I try to keep my expectations very low. It's hard to bring back like some sort of like, you know, any canon after it's been off the air for, almost 15 years. So I wasn't expecting a great movie. I liked stretches of it. I think some of the performances were fantastic, like specifically Vera Farmiga and Alessandra Nivola and Gandolfini's son, I think were all like fantastic.
Yeah.
But I think that they're was a lot that should have seen the cutting room floor. And it kind of was like two different movies kind of happening at once. Like, are we allowed to say spoilers on here? We assume that people have seen it
already? Yeah, we can. It's fine. It's not like the thing is so much of the story is already known, right? It's not like they're breaking ground. It's kind of just the specifics that it's filling in a lot of ways.
You know, like there's the scene where they're like trying to shake down Leslie Odom's character is kind of like henchman, And, you know, like, it's a very intense scene. A very gruesome thing happens in it. And I'm like, holy shit. And then fucking Silvio's hairpiece flies up. Like, it's like, oh, Silvio. Guy just has his teeth fucking drilled out. And then Silvio's like, whoa, where'd that banana peel come from? Like, you know.
But even that was like, there's a storied history of throwing guys on tables in mob movies and doing stuff to them. And it, like, didn't go farther than a guy getting his eye fucking popped out of his head. It was okay, this is like a milder form of something else I've seen. I'm not sure how this adds to the canon, or even, like, in Sopranos fashion, if it made it... I guess you could argue the Silvio thing makes it goofier. And that's one thing I couldn't sort of shake about this whole movie, is that so much of the Sopranos just... reason for being is this sort of deglamorizing mob life, mob movies, showing things that you've seen before, but in like pathetic, stupid ways, with the way it actually, you know, close to the way it actually might go down with the people who are actually in the mob. And so, like, a lot of the things that were happening, I'm like, is this part of it just trying to seem goofy as shit? Like, I couldn't reconcile the weird Christopher voiceovers, which were obviously insanely dumb, which were supposed to be, because Christopher is insanely dumb, but then a lot of the movie had a very serious tone, and I'm like, is this supposed to be mocking of serious tone?
I didn't.
Sorry, keep going.
No, but like the pinky shake. Into like the doom, 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 like the theme starting, and like it's like, yeah, Tony's in the mob now.
Yeah, I guess
come on, David Chase, come on.
Do you know? Like, I think one thing that I like, just after watching it, I felt like if they just told Chase, like, we're gonna give you 5 fucking movies to do, whatever number it is, like. Mm-hmm. I think it could have been much better than, and like, I mean, I have a feeling they're probably going to make another one or two, because like, really, we didn't, like, Tony's not even close to being in the mob yet, you know, like he's just still a kid. He hasn't gone to fucking college yet, right? Like, that's an entire part of his kind of like transformation is that he actually does go to college.
We need to see him at Seton Hall for a semester. Yeah.
Yeah. And find out for real that he wasn't a varsity athlete. Some of those guys were fucking 7 feet tall, some of them. but like, you know, I agree with that. I do think, like, some of it is, you know, some of the stuff in The Sopranos, like, you know, James, you'd mentioned this, like, it, and you did too, Dave, but, like, it was goofy, right? Like, some of the stuff in the movie. But, you know, when you've watched The Sopranos a few thousand times, like we have, you kind of pick up on, like, things that are funny, and they're, like, in really gruesome moments. And I feel like Chase was going for that. But it was done in a very kind of like, you know, just very B-movie style way versus like in The Sopranos, it's very subtle, right? Like some of the stuff that's hilarious is really subtle.
Yes.
And in this one, it was very much like in your face, like, oh, look at this. We're going to kill somebody. But also Paulie's worried about his suit and Silvio's hairpiece is going to come off. But like beyond that, I also, there were a couple things I didn't like. I hated the Ray Liotta double role thing. Like I didn't get that. It wasn't even like explained at all. It was just kind of like, oh, by the way, he has a twin brother. Like, oh, okay, cool. Like,
I almost couldn't tell if that was like real. I was like, does he actually exist? Because he's also having this like fever dream of the beat ball, like where everyone's like, we love you, Dickie Moldesai.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm not even sure that's real. That he,
what do you think? Okay,
let
me ask you this, James. What do you think is more real, the brother in prison or Pussy Bumpin' Sarah's masseuse?
Trick question. The answer is that beautiful Italian woman who moves in next door.
Blind baseball. Did it like exist?
I just want to say that I feel like the pinky swear into the Sopranos theme could have been the greatest moment in cinema. The whole tone of the movie was like just so ridiculous like that, and like I don't even like it, you know what I mean? I'm exaggerating a bit for effect, but it just was like so all over the place. And those moments that you're talking about, Ashwin, where it's like this really dark but also really funny moments, I feel like it's just really hard to get to that place in a movie, especially when you're trying to cover the story of 100 characters. You know, if they pared it down to like four people and you could get deep into smaller moments and you're seeing the way that they lie to themselves and lie to other people and the way that that sort of like weaves into how they act and how they lie to themselves. You know, it's but you don't get there because everything's such a surface treat. There's so much plot to cover that it was hard to get into those details.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. It was fun though. Like, I'm not gonna lie, I had a lot of fun watching it. I didn't go in with great expectations. I was not expecting some like all time classic. I did think some, like, I thought some of the scenes were shot really well though. Like the scene with Dickie and his Gumar, and they're at the ocean, let's just call it. I thought that was like shot really, really well. That was like, it was kind of like, when it was happening, I was like, wait, is this happening right now? Like, is he about to do this thing? So I don't know. Some of that was done really well. And like, you know, it was just, I thought the entire stuff with Leslie Odom, like that entire arc, that could have been so good. And it felt like they punted on that for like this whole fucking thing with Junior. And like, I don't even mind the Junior plot twist, but like, neither of those storylines was developed well enough that it like resonated really. That's what I thought of it anyway.
Right. Yeah. And the whole like Leslie Odom like sleeping with the Gumar, you just didn't need that, because I think you also didn't need Dickie killing her. You know, I don't think you need any of that. Like we already know he's a bad guy. Like, he killed his father. You know, we don't need to see him. Like, he made sure that like he put a drill in someone's fucking mouth and turn it on. Like, you know.
I guess that was pretty fun. I take my criticism of
that. Actually, I'm going to see this second watch. I feel like I'm going to enjoy Silvio more. No, honestly, the guy who played Silvio, like, come on, guy.
Well, he's annoying. He's also annoying in he was in, what the fuck is it? The Big Short. He's in that. He's the annoying, like, he's the annoying guy that like trades out of his mom's garage or whatever. But like, he was just such a shitty pick for Silvio. Because Silvio's kind of like
the actors that were successful at playing people that we already know from the show, clearly did the work and clearly like tried to find a nice balance between like making it the same person without it being some sort of impression. That guy, it was like, holy shit, I'm at like a fucking improv show. And he got like, and someone in the audience, like, their suggestion was Silvio Dante. And he's like, okay.
And Silvio is like a ridiculous cartoon, but people also become caricatures of themselves as they grow older. So there's room to like roll that back, you know, like plant the seeds, but, you know, we don't have to. You don't have to show us the diseased, rotting fruit lying on the ground.
Like
that scene where we like meet them at the bar. It was just like, why are you literally like, why are you doing this right now? Like, stop. I also didn't realize that the age gap between Tony and Silvio was that significant. That was actually surprising
for me. I think that's bullshit.
Yeah, that's,
they have daughters the same age. Like, and there's a part in the show, remember when Ralphie's like getting Jackie Jr. and Dino's really like all fired up, and they eventually like go hit the card game. And he's talking about, like, you know, when we were kids, like, we had our own little crew, you know, me, your father, Silvio Dante and Tony Soprano. I'm like, yeah, they were peers. Like, they, like, that made no sense to me. No sense. Like, I could see Pussy being a little older than Tony, but like, Silvio should be around the same age. That made no sense to me.
Yeah. The unless, like, you know, he's just got early set baldness and is actually like, yeah, it's like, he's like super young or something.
We all know someone who went bald at like 18, right? It is possible. Technically,
that's true. No, it is possible. It just like wasn't explained.
It was
just like, wait,
all those hair pieces in college.
Yeah, and also it's like, were you
with a hair
like,
piece when we were 18? You know,
exactly.
Well, it's also like, was he a made guy at this point? Like, they didn't really like do a good job of explaining that either, because he's like already working for Dickie, and it's just, yeah, it's like a lot of it's kind of like not developed well enough.
Dickie did an okay job, but like, for him to be the main character after Tony Soprano, it's night and day. I mean, there's just not nearly the like intensity, the depth of you know, like humanity or evil or whatever mixture of the two that you see in Tony. And I guess some of that could be just the script. But the character himself, I didn't find nearly as interesting. Whereas like the, what was the name of the black guy who was his high school football teammate? I think you said it a couple times.
Was the numbers runner? The actor?
Whatever, the character or the actor.
I don't remember that.
Harold McBrayer.
That's right, yeah. Harold McBrayer. Like, that could have been a really interesting Tony-like character, because he's all like, oh, black power, but I use it to start my own mob and, like, and like let my best friend get murdered, you know? Like, he's not... That's an interesting form of black power. But, like, you know, that could have had some real depth to it and some interesting... But they just weren't able to get into it, you know?
Well, also just, like, that relationship between them, because it doesn't... It seems like... They're friends, but they're also like business partners. So you can see, like, early in the movie, there are parts where those things are kind of like interacting with each other in weird ways, right? Like when he challenges him in front of kind of like his entire, when like Dickie challenges him, when he comes to drop off the money and he's like, what the fuck is going on here? Like, you're short constantly. And like that, you know, that entire thing could have really been developed well. And then also, just going back to what you said about the Guar, like, so, like, I mean, there's no real explanation for how it happens. It's just, like, he sees her twice and, like, basically gives her fuck me eyes, and that's enough to just be like, okay, now I desperately need to cheat on Dickie to teach him a lesson and sleep with this guy. Like, it didn't make any... It just wasn't... It was just kind of like, all of a sudden, you're like, oh, so... What? Like
yeah, okay. Sleeping together was a little too, like, Breaking Bad. Like, the DEA agent in charge of my case is my uncle, is my brother-in-law or whatever the fuck Walter Hank was, you know. It's like, okay, that's pretty convenient.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, let's move on to the meat of this episode. We're just going to randomly draw connections to Sopranos characters with various storylines affecting the NBA currently and NBA players that happen to play for the New York Knicks. I guess I would like to start with Ben Simmons, because I find this entire thing extremely, extremely interesting. I don't know if you guys saw a story that came out today in the Philly Voice by Kyle Newbeck, but in it, it basically said that Rich Paul, like, it basically reveals that Rich Paul didn't think that they were actually, like, he was actually going to get fined, and they, like, went to the Players Association and were like, this fine is ridiculous, and they're like, yeah, well, like, that's... the fine, like, I don't know what to tell you, and you're not gonna get that money back. So they're like caught surprised by this. But then also, I'm just gonna read this excerpt off, because I think it's fucking absurd for this to be an excuse, but I'm just gonna read it off. A source familiar with the conversations between Simmons's camp and the Sixers told Philly Voice that the only consistent or clear message this offseason was about the accelerated timeline Simmons has been evaluated on compared to other number one overall picks. In most instances, Agent Rich Paul and others have pointed out, top picks are sent to bad teams where they can figure out who they are and how their career is going to play out. Having missed his first year out of LSU due to injuries, Simmons joined Embiid to form a partnership capable of winning 50 games right away, and the Sixers have been considered contenders, or at least pseudo-contenders, at various points during the last three seasons, increasing scrutiny on his development. That is like the worst excuse I think I've ever heard in my entire life. And like, they paid him a max. So it's
what
not
am I
like,
supposed to do with this good team around me? Win games?
I don't know who to start with here, because there's so many characters really involved in this Philly thing, but I feel like you've got to start with Ben Simmons, right? Like,
yeah.
Who is he, and what the fuck kind of like, how do you let your agent leak this? Like, yeah, dude, this is fine. This is going to make me look really good. I think a lot of teams are going to want to fucking trade for me now.
I mean, to me, like, he's kind of like Matt Bevilacqua, like, just thinks he deserves more, like, importance, like, in a culture than he actually, like, has earned. And eventually it just, like, fucks him, because he's like, oh, really? Yeah, I'm just going to fucking shoot Christopher. That'll probably be good. Yeah, I'll just hold out, and something good will happen for me, and not so much.
I was along the same lines. I was thinking he was like maybe a Christopher, you know, like like what? Same thing. When am I going to be made? Meanwhile, all he's done is brought in Brendan Fallone,
aka Junior. That's it.
And he's like, what's my arc? What am I going to be, a main man? And then I think, like, Polly is maybe Embiid. And he's like, yeah, you know, I grew up, became half a superstar. So what? That's my arc. And Fallone in this case is the entourage that Ben Simmons is rumored to bring everywhere he goes.
Yep.
Full of his dumb friends. So that's kind of what my mind went to immediately. But I also like Bevilacqua because he's even less legitimate, and so that might be more appropriate.
And I think the Bevilacqua thing also works really well because, like, the thing that, like, pushes him over the top, right, is, like, when him and Sean are at the strip club, and he's just like, this is bullshit, I went to Rutgers! Like, I think he's like, yeah, and it's just like, what does that have to do with being in the mob, man? like, it doesn't even matter.
Shoot him in the back in the projects?
Like, I think figuring out who Rich Paul is a lot more interesting, because to me, he's like Jackie Jr. to me, right? Like, his connection to the mafia is, like, or in Rich Paul's case, his connection to the game of basketball, like, how he's kind of risen up, is because he's really good friends with LeBron James, and he became his agent, and he miraculously was able to land him multiple max contracts, which is truly spectacular stuff for LeBron James's agent. And he was also miraculously able to get the Lakers to trade everything they could for Anthony Davis, and also to land him a max contract. Like, I don't know if any other agent in NBA history could have pulled off these kind of, like, power moves. But sarcasm aside, like, in the sense of, you know, Jackie Jr. and why he's, like, such a kind of failure, he starts, oh, yeah, like, don't worry, I know Chris, like, you can start dealing at the club. Like, that kind of strikes me in the same way as, you know, we had the Nerlens Noel stuff with Rich Paul, right? And he's, like, he basically took him on as a client and then didn't perform any of his duties and, like, in a lot of ways was neglectful of him, but at least based on the allegations. So, like, that's kind of, like, what Jackie Jr. does, right? Because he has that conversation with, is it Matouche? Is it a touche that comes to him and is like, yeah, he's like, oh, I want to deal stuff at the club. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'll talk to Chris. And Chris is like, no, get the fuck out of here. Furio, right? Furio's like, dude,
yeah,
I don't.
Furio fucks him up. Yeah.
Yeah. Furio's like, dude, I don't give a shit if you talk to, Jackie Jr. like, who is he? Like, and that's kind of what it feels like with Rich Paul, where it's like, he has these connections to significant figures, and because of that he has a high profile. But if you actually just look at the work, like, what has he done? I don't find his, like, what has he done? Like, and really, if you look at some of the things that have happened, like, Nerlens Noel turned down a 4-year $70 million contract because Rich Paul basically told him that's a bad contract and I can get you more. And people will try to be like, well, that's, you know, that's Noel, like, he's got it. It's like, okay, dude, but, like, you have agents, like, agents that promise you stuff and then don't deliver on it are bad agents. And then you also have, like, people forget this one, but we got Marcus Morris, right? And he was a clutch client. He was a clutch client initially, and he dropped him after he had agreed to that deal with San Antonio, which was like 2 years, $20 million or something, and drops him. And then, you know, the GOAT executive of all time, Steve Mills, jumps in and gives him a 1-year, $15 million contract. But, like, that's just an example of, like, dude, that guy found a better contract within 5 seconds. And what, you got him a 2-year, $20 million deal in fucking San Antonio? Like,
well, you said something earlier that shocked me to my core, which is he didn't realize they could get fined that. Like,
I'll
pull up
the article right now.
If you have a job, you need to do the bare minimum of due diligence when you're about to make a move like that. Like, maybe ask a lawyer, you know, maybe tweet at Larry Kuhn and be like, is this okay?
I'll read it off to you. Despite assurances through various media members of note, a league source says the financial significance of holding out is starting to take hold in Ben Simmons' camp. After being fined for missing Philadelphia's preseason loss to the Toronto Raptors on Monday night, a penalty of roughly $360,000. Give me that $360,000, Ben! Simmons' representation had another discussion with the Players Association, in which it was reiterated they would be unable to recoup the money being deducted from the $8.25 million sitting in escrow, sources say. And it was communicated to the Sixers that these early fines were perhaps higher than they expected. Like, okay, you're crying because the fines are higher? Like, how terrible are you at your job?